that will in the next couple of days, and I'll post any recommended reading on the website, so please keep an eye on it. Friday and Saturday, if we can put something up there for that. Also, we should have arranged the Wheeler and Zurich coach to be on reserve at the library. So I don't know if it's for now or the day, but you should be able to access it, to look at the papers, photocopy them, see what you want to do your project on. Also, which is also good reading in that game. But if there's any difficulties with that, please let us know.
So reserve this, and library said okay, but I didn't go personally there. Just getting the things again.
All right, so with that, let's start now. Let's develop that second lecture on statistical interpretation. Today, we're hearing more about probability and its interpretation, and its relevance to interpreting one mistake, as well as some other topics. Okay, just welcome our speaker again.
Yep, thanks a lot, isn't it? Okay. Let me just recap briefly what I was doing in the previous lecture. When we're comparing different interpretations of quantum mechanics and assessing their relative merits, it's common enough to assess them on the qualities like logical economy of postulates and naturalness and things like that. But what I was trying to do is find situations in which it actually makes a difference, which interpretation do you adopt. And most of the time in quantum mechanics it doesn't, but you can find situations in which it does. And the main theme towards the end of the lecture that I was talking about was that some interpretations require a collapse of the wave vector or a projection postulate in order to complete them. And I said that can get you into trouble. Afterwards, I had some private conversations with Shelley Goldstein, and he was afraid that because our languages are almost orthogonal to each other, you're going to get the impression that the experts completely disagree with each other and everything's up in the air, and that isn't what either of us believed. So we had a good private talk and came to the conclusion that we agreed on most things. And I think that where he talks about collapse of the wave vector, collapse of the state vector, would coincide with the situations where I said the collapse postulate is innocuous. It doesn't give you the wrong answer, it gives you the right answer. It gives you the same answers if you don't use it. And I hope he wouldn't be using it when I said you shouldn't, and I rather doubt that he would. So appearances notwithstanding, was probably not near as much disagreement between us as you might have thought. Now I want to move over to a different set of examples where it makes a difference. The difference isn't so great necessarily as that you get the wrong answer with the wrong interpretation, but rather one interpretation can lead you directly to the answer and the other can lead you on a wild goose chase, although you may eventually get to the right answer. And I'll be contrasting an individual interpretation versus the ensemble interpretation. That is, does the state vector describe, is it a complete description of the individual system? According to one interpretation, that's supposed to be the case. Or is it a description of an ensemble of similarly prepared systems, according to another interpretation, which is the one that's supporting? That's supposed to be the case. Now, this example comes from an actual historical situation, which I'll describe after I've done the mathematics for it.
Good.
Which way function? The situation is it arose in electron interferometry, where you have a beam of particles that are generated, and it's not a mono-energetic beam. Different electrons come off with different energies, and if you ascribe a wave function to the individual particle, then there are two extreme hypotheses that you could adopt as to what the wave function of the individual particle is. According to the first hypothesis, each electron is emitted in an energy eigenstate, that is the Swain wave here, but the energy varies from one emission to the next, and so the whole beam has to be described by a mixed state, by a density matrix, which will take into account the fact that you have this mixture of energy states. The second hypothesis says, no, individual particles aren't emitted as plane waves. They're emitted as wave packets, and the wave packets are a Fourier synthesis of all the possible energies. So according to the second hypothesis, each electron is emitted with a wave packet that's a Fourier synthesis of the different plane waves. And whereas in hypothesis A, the electrons were distinguished by the different energy, in hypothesis B, the electrons are distinguished by the time of emission, T naught. So since you've got different wave functions in the two cases, you might think that this is experimentally distinguishable. And there was a great deal of argument on the floor of a conference in 1956, I think it was. As to what the differences would be, people disagreed with each other as to what the differences were. Robert Dickey was smarter than the average guy, and he recognized that there were no differences, which I don't claim to be obvious yet. He tried to explain that on the floor, but you just can't get subtle points like that across when you're speaking in discussions at a conference. And so he never succeeded in getting it across in that particular context. Well, let's see what the actual difference is between the predictions of these two hypotheses. Okay, first of all, start with hypothesis A. We have a mixed state operator for a particle from the beam, and each particle has a definite energy eigenstate. Well, we take a mixture of energy eigenstates then. The density matrix, or an operator form, is expressed in the usual way. Take the outer product of the state vector, hypothetical state vector of the individual particles. Now, average over them with the appropriate weight for the different energies. And when I calculate the density matrix in coordinate representation, then this is the integral of the wave function, psi sub k of x of t times psi star sub k of x of t, integrated over over the weighting function, w of omega. These psi's were just plane waves. They all have the psi and the psi and the psi star have the same frequency, so the e to the I omega t part cancels, and you just have the spatial dependence, which is an e to the I k x minus x prime averaged over the energy distribution. Okay, that's what you get for the density matrix according to hypothesis A. Look and see what we get for the density matrix according to hypothesis B. You have to average then, in this case, over the emission time. The psi sub t is a wave packet, which was written down on previous transparency. So psi is this Fourier integral. Psi star is this Fourier integral. And then we average over the time. So we've got a whole bunch of integrations to do here.
I got this lined up so you can see it all.
OK, the thing we do then is, first of all, we take the do the time integral first. Like most theoretical physicists were quite confident that we can interchange the orders of integration. Mathematicians criticize us for that, but it's not really relevant here. So if we take the integral over t naught first, you can see what factors we're going to get. We'll get the factor of e to the, I omega t naught. And we'll get a factor of, I guess, e to the, e to the minus I omega prime. And then we'll be integrating this with respect to t naught from minus capital T by 2 to plus capital T by 2, taking the limit as t tends to infinity. Well, this integral, if I leave the limits finite, gives a sharply peaked function. And as I go to the limit as t tends to infinity, I get something like a delta function. The point is that this integral is, of course, equals 0 in the limit if omega is not equal to omega prime. So I can just, when I put in the delta function and reduce the number of integrals, I get the expression at the bottom. Since omega is equal to omega prime, that means k is also equal to k prime. And I get an expression exactly the same as what I have in A, provided we interpret the square of the amplitude A of omega as being the probability W of omega, that's the observed energy probability distribution. So you get exactly the same density matrix in both points of view, and there's no experimental distinction between them.
Is there a relation between this and the positive kinetics and the time amplitudes are equivalent to
ensemble amplitudes? No, that's completely separate. That's nothing to do.
Is that the material without dividing by t?
No, it'd be interesting. Sorry, I just left something out. If you don't divide by t, you get a Dirac delta function. In fact, that'd probably be the more rigorous way of doing it. Then you stick your Dirac delta function in the integral to it and reduce the number of integrals.
The second question is, can you remind us of the hypothesis you utilized that led to the assumption of the nature of emission time?
Assumption A was that every electron is emitted in an energy eigenstate. So that's a plane wave, but with a different k. Assumption B was that it's emitted as a wave packet, which, of course, by Fourier analysis, is a superposition of energy eigenstates, and they differ by the emission times. So you've got a train of wave packets, the average over the emission time. So what we find is the advocates of the, or the believers in the individual interpretation, have been led on a wild goose chase trying to find what the wave function of the individual particle was, but it didn't make any difference. Let me show how this calculation would be done in the ensemble interpretation. In the ensemble interpretation, well, the statistical operator or density matrix is the fundamental entity that describes states. State vector is a special case when you have a pure state. So we go directly to the state operator. First of all, it's a steady state B. That's part of the experimental condition. So that means the time derivative of the density matrix or state operator is equal to zero. If the time derivative is equal to zero, then it has to commute with the Hamiltonian because the equation of motion says that d rho by dt is either plus or minus I, and I don't remember the sign, times the commutator of h with rho. So if it's independent of time, it has to commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay? So that means rho is diagonal in the same representation in which h is diagonal. It's diagonal in terms of the eigenfunctions of h. So it can be written in its diagonal representation. A function of an operator can be written in terms of its eigenfunctions and eigenvectors in this way. And so with some coefficients who in all three of the interpretations has to be determined from experiment, you can get an expression like this, and you get the same expression for the density matrix. The economy of it is logical economy, that no mention was ever made of the individual wave functions. We were not led to entertain such a turned out to be fruitless hypothesis, and we were led directly to the answer instead of proceeding by a wild goose chase. So the people who took the individual interpretation didn't get the wrong answer. It just took them longer to get the right answer. And in 1956, there were a lot of smart guys sitting there saying things from the floor of the conference, which in fact were wrong. I didn't bother reviewing some of the wrong things that they actually said. That is, their intuition led them astray. Once they got home to their offices and sat down and did the calculation, I'm sure every one of them got the right answer. But intuitively, the intuitive expectations that they derived from the individual interpretation led them to expect something that wasn't true.
Sorry. So usually it doesn't make a difference in if you have a state B, if you have a flash spot.
Well, that's a different state, of course. That's a different state.
Then it makes, then
if you have a different state, you have different predictions.
Yeah, no,
I'm talking about one particular experiment, and in this particular experiment, and so was everybody. Everybody was talking about one particular experiment. Of course, if you have a different state, you have different predictions.
I'm not questioning that. Suppose I live in our institution where I do a flash. Then the question of
different state, different prediction.
The question could be still the same. Where is the wave function of the following flash? And there are the two types of hypotheses, wouldn't it?
No, they're wrong. Well, if it's a flash emission, hypothesis A will clearly be inappropriate. And I don't suppose anybody would be so foolish as to make that hypothesis. I'm giving people the benefit of the doubt that they're not stupid.
Saying that only hypothesis B is the right one?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that neither hypothesis nor A is relevant. It depends on the physical nature of the state preparation. So you're saying, what would the answer be if you used a different physical state preparation? And the answer is, well, we have to look in detail at what the apparatus is, and we will indeed figure out how it works. But my problem isn't concerned with other experiments. It's with the fact that in one particular real-life experiment, people were misled.
It's not generic situation. What you're trying to say is that the detail of the wave function seems not to matter. But that's true, as you point out there. I mean, a steady state point of view, right? It's not true, maybe it's true in general, or you don't have a reason, but it's appearing not true in general.
Well, we have to be considering, for this to matter, we have to be considering a situation in which the state is not a pure state, because that is unique way, but it's a mixed state. And if you insist on interpreting a mixed state as a mixture of pure cases, we know mathematically that that resolution is always ambiguous. If you have a mixture, and you ask me, what pure states is this a mixture of, I can answer that question in infinitely many ways, all mathematically correct. So there's always an ambiguity if it's a mixed state. Okay, let me just conclude with a few more historical remarks here. As I said, Dickey tried to explain what I explained to you from the floor of the conference and was apparently frustrated at doing so. So he wrote a letter to the session chairman with copies to all the major participants to straighten them out. And he mentioned the situation obliquely in his quantum mechanics book. And I read between the lines and said, there's got to be something more to this than what he's telling us. And I wrote him a letter, and he said, yes, this is what it is. And he sent a copy of what he's sent to everybody else in 1956. It's an interesting little story. It also has a sequel. In 1983, the confusion was resurrected in some neutron interference experiments, in which certain experts misinterpreted their data as giving information about these so-called individual wave packets of the individual neutrons. And these guys, I won't mention their name, I'll give them my textbook, these guys are first-rate experimentalists, but nevertheless, they were led astray. Fortunately, somebody wrote a reply in his rev, straightening them out, so the confusion didn't last too long. Okay, so the moral of the story is that one interpretation leads you directly to the right answer, and the other interpretation doesn't prevent you from getting the right answer, but it certainly can mislead you and delay you along the path. Another situation in which the individual interpretation sort of led people to a brick wall, and the ensemble interpretation showed you the way forward, is in the problem of quantum chaos. Now, first of all, I guess I need to explain what chaos is rather briefly. First of all, for classical chaos, is where chaos is actually defined. You can divide classical states into two types, regular states and chaotic states. And the regular states are, well, the Kepler orbits are an excellent example of the regular states. They fit into neat families, parameterized in a neat way, and as you vary the parameters, the states change quantitatively but not qualitatively. That's what regular orbits look like. Chaotic orbits, well, they look something like a bowl of stirred spaghetti. So they're tangled all over the place. In fact, they're even worse than a real bowl of stirred spaghetti is, because one of the common ways of characterizing chaos is to say, let's take an initial starting point, and we have some kind of a trajectory that results from it. Then let's take a starting point that's a little bit, that's close by, but a little bit different, and that'll give you a different trajectory. And let's look at this quantity, the difference between them, which I'll call B of T. Now, in the regular case, B of T goes generally like order of t. In the chaotic case, b of t goes like something like e to the lambda t. That is, it increases exponentially with a positive lambda. So there's really a mathematically qualitative difference between these two states. It's not just a qualitative difference, like the difference between two species of chickens or something, where you it may be a matter of taste where you draw the boundary because they're so similar to each other. There's really a qualitative difference. So that's what chaos is in classical theory. Quantum chaos then poses the question, first of all, is there something in quantum mechanics that's analogous to this, which we call quantum chaos? And regardless of the answer to the question of whether there's chaos of this sort in quantum mechanics, there's a fundamental question, and that is, how does classical chaos emerge out of quantum mechanics? Well, if you take the quantum state vector and the individual interpretation and think of it as being the analog of an individual classical state, that is these individual orbits, then you very quickly run up against the following problem. Here's a proof that there's no quantum chaos. We take two states, psi 1 and psi 2, that are initially close together, and we measure the distance between them by the inner product. Now, unitarity of the time evolution implies that the inner product is constant. You do a unitary transformation on two vectors, and it doesn't change the inner product. That's even a mathematical way of defining the unitary operator. So the states do not diverge, and therefore there's no quantum chaos. And there certainly was a time not too many years ago when a lot of people took this argument at face value. But there are a lot of problems with this argument.
You might strengthen the argument to mention that this inner product is directly related to a natural distance measure on the state. So you can
yeah.
The arc goes to that.
Yeah, that's
something
right.
It's non-negative, it's outside the triangle equality. So the natural measure of distance is an obvious student.
Yeah, it's even more natural than what I suggested. That's right. Okay, there's problems with this argument. This not only proves that there's no quantum chaos, if you define it this way, and it runs into irreparable conflict with the classical limit, because it not only does it not allow them to separate exponentially, it doesn't allow them to separate at all. If it happened to have been the case that the quantum state separated but sub-exponentially, then in the limit as h bar goes to zero, it is conceivable that a non-exponential increase could converge in a non-uniform fashion to an exponential increase in the singular limit, just as polynomials converge as a Taylor series to the exponential function. But there's no chance of that. The limit of zero is zero, no matter how you define the limit. And so there's no separation whatsoever. And this is not only incompatible with classical chaos, it's incompatible with classical mechanics, provided you regard the quantum state vector in the individual interpretation and think of it as being the analog of the classical state, of the individual classical trajectory.
Sir?
Yeah.
No, the classical sense. So chaos is sort of when you take two points close in the face of each other.
Mm-hmm.
In quantum mechanics, because of Heisenberg's, being close in the face space sort of doesn't make too much sense because you don't
It makes more sense than you might think, but that of course wasn't the argument being used here. Let me go on to the next part and show that, in fact, if that's a proof that there's no classical, if that's accepted as a proof that there's no quantum chaos, then I'll give you a proof that there's no classical chaos. So it's a reductio ad absurdum argument. Let us use classical mechanics in the Liouville form, where we have a distribution function in phase space. F1 and F2 are two initially close classical phase space distributions. And now it's a property of the Liouville equation, which if you don't know, you just have to take my word for it, that the evolution is such that the overlap between these two distributions will be constant in time. So if I define this as a curly bracketed inner product in analogy with the pointy bracketed inner product that we have in quantum mechanics, it's also the case that classical states do not diverge if states are defined in the Liouville sense rather than the Newtonian sense. So there's a strong analogy between the quantum and the classical mechanics, provided you take the analog of the quantum state to be a classical statistical distribution. Now, okay, why does this not prove that there's no classical chaos? We already know that there is classical. So I said this proof is in quotation marks because it's supposed to be a reductio ad absurdum. Well, let's look at the analogous situation, but in the Liouville sense. So here we have, I'm only going to use one axis for all the dimensions of phase space, but I have one Liouville distribution. This is my F1. And here's another Liouville distribution. This is my F2. And my distance d of t is this separation between them. And according to classical chaos, d of t increases exponentially. according to the theorem I just gave you, the inner product between F1 of t and F2 of t is constant. Well, yeah, it's constant. It's equal to zero. It's equal to zero regardless of whether this separation is a millimeter or a month. So the conclusion that I draw here is that the Hilbert space distance is irrelevant to the existence or non-existence of chaos. That's simply the wrong measure. It's the wrong measure in classical mechanics, obviously, if we use the Liouville formulation, and I contend it's also the wrong measure in quantum mechanics. Where we look for chaos in both of these situations, in the Liouville distribution, we look for it in a growth of complexity in the phase space distribution. It would take me a whole other talk to discuss all this here, so I'll just be content with giving you the main idea that chaos is to be seen not in the separation of two adjacent Liouville distributions, but rather in the fact that these distributions become very complicated, very complex in detail as time goes on. And so where we look for chaos in quantum mechanics will have to be done in a similar way. Look for growth and complexity in the quantum probabilities that are calculated from the quantum state vector, just as we look for it in the complexity of the classical probabilities here. So this is an example of a situation where, if you use the individual interpretation, at least in this particular way, you run into a brick wall and can't make any progress at all. But once you pass to the ensemble interpretation, then the door is suddenly open for you, and all sorts of progress can be made. And as I say, it's a whole research area in which I could easily give an hour talk, but I can't do so today, obviously. For questions before I move on to the next topic? No. Okay. Well, the next topic is also one in which, if you take the individual interpretation, you sort of run up against the wall. But if you take the ensemble interpretation, things open up for you. And that's the classical limit of quantum mechanics. How do classical properties emerge from quantum mechanics? First of all, let me give you the answer before I give you the argument to support it, because I find that in this subject, nothing makes sense unless you understand this. The classical limit of a quantum state is not a single classical orbit, it's an ensemble of classical orbits. That's not a very surprising conclusion if you've absorbed the notion that quantum mechanics makes only statistical predictions. It doesn't predict definite results for experiments in general. So why should it predict definite orbits in the classical limit? How could it be otherwise? Just comment on this before. A little bit more mathematical precision of what I mean by the classical limit. Generically speaking, it's letting h bar go to zero and the quantum number tend to infinity such that the action is constant. Generally speaking, when we take the classical limit, if you take the classical limit physically, what you have to do is take the system bigger and bigger. The classical action has to get big compared with h bar. Mathematically, we like to keep the action constant and let h bar go to zero and the quantum number go to infinity. Just so that everything's normalized on a common scale of our graphs.
Really, h bar divided by
yeah, that's right. That's right. So I'm not playing a theoretician's game where I imagine a universe with a different value of h bar, as some people actually do in cosmology. We form dimensionless ratios with h bar in the numerator and some dynamical quantities in the denominator, and we pass to the limit as this dimensionless ratio goes to zero, which in practice involves taking bigger systems or stronger fields. The precise definition of the ratio depends on the individual system, but roughly speaking, it's h bar to zero, quantum number to infinity with the product constant. Okay, I'm asserting this, and there's lots of evidence to support it, but let's think, why would one ever not believe, perhaps? How could you ever expect a single classical orbit to emerge from quantum mechanics in the classical limit? Well, there's one important theorem in quantum mechanics that might suggest that, and that's Ehrenfest's theorem. Well, what Ehrenfest's theorem says, just stated in words, is that if you take a narrow enough wave packet, the centroid of this wave packet will follow a classical trajectory. And so you might hope that in the classical limits, defined appropriately in each particular case, maybe the probabilities all condense onto this one orbit, and that's the classical orbit. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, as we'll see. Well, I referred to Ehrenfest theorem, and we need to know exactly what it is. Here's Ehrenfest theorem for a simple case involving one degree of freedom. We have a Hamiltonian. The hat indicates an operator here. So this is Hamiltonian equals kinetic energy p squared over 2m plus potential energy v of q. Everything's an operator. Heisenberg's equation of motion says that the rate of change of the position operator with time is given by the commutator of q with the Hamiltonian, and it's just equal to the momentum operator divided by mass. Rate of change of the momentum operator, by similar argument, is equal to the force operator, where we define the force operator as being the operator given by just taking the negative gradient of the potential energy and substituting the position operator for x. Now let us take the average of these equations in some state. The angular brackets indicates a quantum average. It could be a pure state with a wave function, or it could be a mixed state with a density matrix. It doesn't matter. For simplicity, maybe just think of a state of it being done with a state vector. So the first equation is trivial. The rate of change of average position is the average momentum divided by mass. Second equation is the one that has that we need to worry about. The rate of change of average momentum is the average force. And here comes the crucial statement that even some textbooks fail to emphasize well enough. If the average force can be approximated by the force at the average position, then this equation just becomes Hamilton's classical equations for the averages, average q and average p. And so then the average position will follow a classical orbit. So that's what I said in words. So this will be true if the wave packet is narrow enough. Its centroid will follow a classical orbit. The problem with regarding this as the necessary and sufficient condition for classicality is that it always breaks down. Wave packets always spread, except for the harmonic oscillator. If they spread so slowly that it would be the age of the solar system before they got big, wouldn't worry about it. But in chaotic systems, they actually spread exponentially rapidly, with the same exponent, as a matter of fact. For macroscopic systems, for macroscopic chaotic systems, you can start with a microscopic wave packet and do the calculation and see that in an observable time, it'll be as big as the size of the system. And so Ehrenfest theorem will break down on observable time scales. Do you have a question here?
So why does the Earth seem to revolve around the sun?
It
doesn't work.
Well, you're just asking me to continue with the lecture because I'm just explaining to you why Ehrenfest theorem is not adequate to define the classical limit. But I still have to do a little bit more before I tell you what is the problem. Let's calculate the corrections to Ehrenfest theorem. So what I do is define deviation operators. Delta q is q minus q average. Delta p is p minus p average. And I substitute it into the equations of the previous transparency. And my force, f of q, where I write q equals q plus delta q, I expanded in the Taylor series. And this is all operators. Then you take the average, and you get the numerical quantities here. So the first equation, again, is trivial. The rate of change of average momentum is given by the average force. The first order term cancels out because the average of delta q to the first power is zero, by definition of the average. So you get the average of delta q squared. That's the second moment of the distribution. And the higher order term involving the third derivative of f with the third moment of delta q, and so on. A whole infinite series of moments. And if we could stop right here, we'd get the classical orbit. And here we get the corrections. Unfortunately, those corrections are not all due to quantum mechanics. I first noticed this when I actually had a master's student, and I said, wouldn't it be a good project if you worked out quantitatively what these quantum corrections are in a few simple systems? So we went away and did it, came to me, and I looked at his answers and said, hey, your corrections don't go to zero with h bar. What's going on? And then I very quickly realized what was going on. And here's what's going on. There's a perfect classical analog of Ehrenfest theorem, too. too bad we don't have two projectors, but the structure is so similar that you hopefully you can map. Let us work with the classical Liouville distribution in phase space, and we define a classical average of positions, classical average of momentum, do the same sort of thing, take the average in some classical statistical state, then the rate of change of average position is the average momentum over mass, the rate of change of average momentum is the average force, well, it's classical average now, expand the force in Taylor series, and we get exactly the same structure of the equation. And the conclusion is that if the distribution is narrow enough, the centroid of your probability distribution follows a classical trajectory. But if your distribution is broad, it does not follow a classical trajectory. And what's true of classical probabilities is true of quantum probabilities. And most of the dominant terms in the corrections to Liouville's theorem just have to do strictly with the fact that you're dealing with a probability cloud and the centroid doesn't have to follow a classical trajectory, and that's the same whether it's classical probabilities or quantum probabilities. This leads me to define something that I have to put in every introduction to every paper I write and every introduction to every talk I give at conferences to try and get this into people's heads. I think most of them have got it now, but it took a while. There, you can define two regimes of quantum classical correspondence, what I call the Ehrenfest regime, in which the width of the quantum and also the classical probability distributions are small compared to the scale of the system. And if that's true, the centroid of the state, whether it's the quantum state or the classical state, approximately follows a classical trajectory. That's Ehrenfest theory. In the, what I call the Liouville regime, the quantum and classical probability distributions are approximately equal, but they don't have to be narrow. Ehrenfest theorem is completely irrelevant. The corrections would be huge. And the proper way to estimate the breakdown of the classicality is not by the breakdown of Ehrenfest theorem, but by when the difference between quantum and classical probabilities ceases to be small. And this criterion for classicality is much more robust than the Ehrenfest criterion. That is, it extends over a larger period of time. Again, this is another subject in which I could quite easily give a whole hour's talk, but will not do so because it wouldn't be appropriate. Some of the results of this study are the following. If we consider the deviations from Ehrenfest theorem, that is, I tried to equate this a little while ago, that is the difference between the centroid of the wave packet and a single classical trajectory, which is the comparison that's suggested by the individual interpretation of the state, we find that those deviations don't depend strongly on H bar. That's not obvious. I'm just telling you some results of more detailed calculations that I've done over the years and have published. The corrections to Ehrenfest theorem do not depend strongly on H bar. What they depend on is the size of the initial state. You saw that from the equations, actually, where the leading correction was just the second moment of the position probability distribution. The width of the initial wave packet is the important thing in determining how big the deviations from Ehrenfest theorem will be and how rapidly they will grow. And as I said already, I'll say it again, it doesn't depend very strongly on H bar. If we go to the Liouville comparison and say, okay, you shouldn't be comparing with a single classical trajectory, you should be comparing quantum probability distribution with a classical probability distribution. Those differences are, of course, much smaller in absolute value, but the interesting thing about them is that they turn out that they're not sensitive to the size of the initial state. And they scale as h bar squared, for narrow states at least. For broader states, they scale in a different way. So, adopting the ensemble interpretation rather than the individual interpretation, first of all, it gets us away from a brick wall where we couldn't understand a lot of things and opens up a whole new vista of interesting research questions. At least I consider them interesting because I'm working on them. Just to give you a flavor of it, I'll give you one result. Which unfortunately I didn't give the reference to this paper. It's in Physical Review. And I have to define the system here. This is a system of two coupled pendulums. So the coordinate of the pendulum is theta 1 and theta 2. We've got two of them, of course. And there's a coupling between them that goes as cosine theta 1 minus theta 2. this is a nice dynamical system, and it's simple enough that it's easy to do the computer program, but it's complicated enough that it shows regular trajectories and chaotic trajectories, the full range of behavior, and also it can be done both quantum mechanically and classically. So what I've calculated is for this system, the maximum quantum classical difference, I guess I should have told you one other thing. Typically, the quantum classical distance grows, but does not reach the size of the system. It saturates itself. Whereas the deviations from Ehrenfest's theorem grow until they reach the size of the system. They can't grow any bigger. And when you do the Liouville comparison, typically the quantum classical differences do not grow that big. There's a maximum. The quantities that I considered are the average momentum of the two pendulums, that's one symbol, the width of the momentum probability distribution, that's another, and the correlation, C12, the correlation between the momentum of the two pendulums. And what we find is that they all show the same sort of trends. For regular states, if you now consider what this maximum is and vary your dimensional as h bar, these maxima go to zero as h bar goes to zero, and in the regular case scales with h bar squared. In the chaotic case scales as h bar to the power of 2/3. So this poses another challenge. How generic is this? Can anybody prove by more analytic methods extracting these asymptotic behaviors other than what I've done is to do it just numerically? So adopting the ensemble interpretation has opened up a whole new interesting vista of research. You wouldn't even pose the question if you were using the individual. Okay, any questions before I go on to a totally different subject? Okay, so the moral of these two examples is not that one interpretation gave you the wrong answer and the other one gives you the right answer, but rather the individual interpretation in one case led you on a wild goose case before you got to the right answer, and in this case it led you to a brick wall and you just stopped because you didn't know where to go. Certainly, quantum mechanics involves probability in a fundamental way. We've been talking about probabilities all the time. I expect every speaker you have in this series will talk about quantum probabilities in one way or another. You have seen already and will continue to see that there are different interpretations of quantum mechanics. You may or may not be aware that there are different interpretations of probability. In fact, I think the arguments over probability interpretation are just as severe or even worse, perhaps, than the ones over quantum mechanics. Certainly, they've got a longer history. So since quantum mechanics involves probability, the interpretation of quantum mechanics must be related, or might be at least related, to the interpretations of probability. And it's worthwhile having a look at the different interpretations of probability to see whether they, first of all, to see which ones are relevant to quantum mechanics and how they're relevant, and whether choice of different interpretations of quantum mechanics is related to a choice of different interpretations of probability. Now, as I said, there's a lot of interpretations of probability, and what I'm going to give you now is based on a paper that I presented at a conference on probability theory and physics, which I, first of all, tried to give a useful classification of the interpretations of probability, and secondly, to discuss their relevance to quantum mechanics. Interestingly, I didn't know it at the time, but this conference took place at Växjö in Sweden, which is where the great biologist Linnaeus came from. Linnaeus was the guy who classified all living things into species, genus, phylum, whatever all the terms are. And what I was doing, I discovered, was applying his techniques of taxonomy to probability interpretation. I tried to do a little bit more than that. I also asked the question of whether you can have one interpretation that's the overarching interpretation and the others are to be seen as special cases. But that aspect I don't want to talk about because, number one, it's more speculative and not well established yet, and number two, it's not relevant for our main purpose. But one of my purposes was to get people to stop arguing about what is the true interpretation of Freddie said there. Who's the guy who at the dinner on Tuesday said that he had a religion in which in his church you have to believe all of the interpretations of Quantum Mechanics simultaneously? Not here now, okay. It was a joke, no doubt. But in a sense, that's what I was trying to do for probability theory, not in a frivolous sense, by saying the different interpretations of probability theory are all correct, but they apply to different ranges of subject matter. Probability theory is a branch of mathematics. It's defined by some axioms. Anything that satisfies those axioms is a legitimate instance of probability. For example, we don't argue about what is the true interpretation of group theory. Take the simplest possible group. It contains the identity element and an element whose square is the identity. Now, what's the true interpretation of that? Is it rotation by pi radians? Is it reflection in the mirror? Is it interchange of two identical objects? You will recognize that this is a rather stupid question to be asking. All of those things are legitimate instances of that particular group, and we don't argue about which is the true meaning of the group element. And what I was saying, and a subject that's more abstract than that, is that there are different interpretations of probability, but they apply in different situations. So that's what I want to say, because I can't say everything that's in the paper, and unfortunately I didn't prepare transparencies that are directed at this audience, so there may be some features that are not relevant. Okay, let's just go over these. First of all, probability is a function of two arguments, and you can read P(a/c) as the probability that A is true given the information in C. The exact words you use will depend on your interpretation of probability, but we read that function as the probability of A given C. Now, in the ensemble and frequency class interpretations, probability is identified with the limit frequency in an ordered sequence, if you're using frequency theory, or with a measure on a, or with the measure on a measurable set in ensemble theory. These I consider to be sufficiently similar to put them together in one category. And I listed some names of the most prominent developers and advocates of that point of view. Then we have subjective and personal probabilities. And by the way, this was supposed to be a diagram indicating logical relations. So all three of these are supposed to be on the same level, and this one in blue is supposed to be on a level higher. I don't know whether this one will hold its position on a higher level. It may have to be demoted, so I have four on the same level, but that doesn't concern us today. Okay, the second interpretation, I'm only going to be talking basically about these three. The subjective or personal probabilities, probability describes incomplete knowledge or degrees of reasonable belief. And then the third, the propensity interpretation, propensity is a form of causality that's weaker than determinism. Probability is ascribed to events, and we read this formula P(a/c) as a propensity for A to occur under the condition that C has occurred. Now, although I don't want to talk about the top box very much, I do want to at least give you an advertisement for what I regard as an excellent book on probability theory, and that's a book by Edwin T. James, published posthumously by Cambridge University Press. The work in progress used to be on the web, but as soon as the authors got a publisher's contract, they had to take it off the web. So I'm putting this slide up mainly to advertise what I consider to be a really, really excellent book. I don't agree with 100% of James, but then you don't agree with 100% of anybody, not even your wife. That's a really bad example, isn't it? But it's an excellent book. Okay, I said probability theory is defined by a set of axioms. This is a set of axioms that I prefer. It's the one that James uses due to R.T. Cox in a book, which is a very good book, but religiously hard to explain, hard to think. But you don't really need it because it's all done in James' book, which is in print and is easy to obtain, except you have to pay the price. It's a bit expensive. And also an article in American Journal of Physics. Axiom 1 says that the probability of A given B is a number between 0 and 1. Axiom 2 says that the probability of A given A, that is the probability of a certainty, is 1. Axiom 3 says that the probability of not A given B is 1 minus the probability of A given B. Axiom 4 is the least intuitive. It says that the probability of both A and B together, under some condition, is the probability of A on that condition multiplied by the probability on the original condition C and on the condition that A is already known to be true if it's a proposition, or A is already known to have occurred if it's an event. The negation, not A, requires a particular axiom, axiom 3. The conjunction, A and B, requires its own axiom, that's axiom 4. You might think that this junction, A or B, would require an axiom, but it doesn't require an axiom. The reason it doesn't require an axiom is because the proposition A or B is the same thing as the negation of not A and not B. Or in words, A or B is the opposite of neither A nor B. So if you have just an axiom that defines what happens, what probability of negation is, and the probability of what a conjunction is, by a bit of calculation, which maybe a very densely abbreviated form of the derivation takes about half a page, you derive a theorem that the probability of either A or B under some condition is equal to the probability of A plus the probability of B minus the probability of both A and B. That can be understood very easily in terms of what's known as the Venn diagram. Suppose the area inside this circle is the probability of A, and the area inside this circle is the probability of B. The probability of A or B is the combination of both of them. So this outer thing is the A or B. And the probability of both A and B, well, that's this part here. So if you want the probability of A or B, it's equal to the sum of the probability of A plus the sum of the probability of B, but this is double counted, so you have to subtract. That's the intuitive way of understanding the result. It's not the proof. There is an algebraic proof that's given in all the records. If you specialize to mutually exclusive events, that is, it's impossible for both of these propositions A and B to be true at the same time, or if they're events, it's impossible for both of them to occur. If one of them occurs, it prevents the other from occurring. Then the third term is gone, and you have the familiar additivity of probabilities for mutually exclusive events. And if you've taken a course in probability theory, you were probably given this as an axiom. You can actually show that one set of axioms is equivalent to the other mathematically, but I think this set is preferable because it doesn't require any restrictions on that probability. I'll just stress a couple of points, but I'll only go over them rather briefly. First of all, the notion of randomness plays no fundamental role in probability theory. I'm just going to leave you with that and not argue. But another point, which is interesting in terms of Cox's work, these axioms are not arbitrary in the following sense. If you make certain conditions of plausibility and consistency, as Cox did, he introduced the following qualitative conditions. That the probability of A on some evidence determines also the probability of not A on the same evidence. One of our axioms expressed that quantitatively. He's only expressing it qualitatively with no equations. Also, the probability on a given A evidence that both A and B are true is determined by their separate probabilities, one on the given evidence and the other on the evidence plus the assumption that the first is true. That's fourth axiom, but stated qualitatively. And finally, and probably the most important one of all, if a complex proposition can be composed more than one way, that is, by just putting the parentheses, take the conjunction of C with the conjunction of A and B, you get the same result by taking the conjunction of A with the conjunction of A, of B and C. It shouldn't matter which order you do it in. You're getting to the same condition regardless. Then you must always get the same probability no matter which way you calculate. And what Cox showed is that from these qualitative principles, he could actually deduce the axioms of quantum theory that I gave you essentially uniquely. That is up to a kind of an isomorphism where you just do a functional transformation that doesn't change their content. So this is just to motivate you to study probability theory a little bit more carefully and preferably to study it from somebody like James, not by someone who does it from Kolmogorov's axioms. Finally, another moral point. All probabilities are conditioned. The use of a single variable notation, talking about P of A instead of P of A given C, is permissible only if the conditional information is obvious from the context and never changes throughout the problem. I know of several paradoxes in probability theory that occur because people ignore this proposition. They talk about probabilities as just being P of A, not conditional, and they change horses in midstream. I don't know how many of you are taking courses in probability theory. How many of them? Okay. Did your teachers obey this stricter, or did they violate it? Wait. Obeyed? Oh, that's good. A lot of textbooks violated. Encouraged. Okay, let's come now to the point of this series. I'm skipping over some material in my paper that is relevant. Which interpretations of probability are relevant to quantum mechanics? And my answer here is the ensemble frequency interpretation, yes, rather obviously. The propensity interpretation, yes. The subjective interpretation, no. I should make that a qualified no, because subjective probabilities can enter into certain types of applications of probability, as I'll explain, but I think they've got no place in the foundations of quantum theory. So yes, indeed, subjective probabilities can be legitimately used in the same sense that subjective probabilities can be used in non-quantum physics. So they're not verboten, but they're not part of the foundation.
Sir, you got applications of one kind of
applications of one. I probably said the wrong word. Yeah.
We had a speaker, the many word speaker tried to make it one again. He was using subjective.
Sorry, who is that?
Right, to get in the condition. So for him,
okay, well, I said they're not forbidden, but let me get on with the point and we'll see where they're relevant. Looks like I can find my notes there. Okay, I'll discuss these three interpretations in turn and how they relate to quantum mechanics. First of all, the ensemble frequency interpretation I hardly need to explain anymore because it's already been used. You prepare a system in a certain state, you prepare to do a measurement. You prepare the same state again, do the same measurement, you don't necessarily get the same result. So you prepare it again and measure again, and prepare again and measure again, and you eventually build up enough statistics that by the relative frequency definition of probability, you can effectively measure the probabilities experimentally and compare with the probabilities that are predicted by quantum theory. So certainly the first interpretation of probability is relevant to quantum mechanics. We use it all the time. Somebody want to ask a question?
Yeah, I have actually a question regarding there's many worlds interpretation. Is it true to say that when David Wallace was presenting the many world interpretation?
David who? Sorry?
David Wallace.
Wallace. Okay, well, I don't know what he said, so I can't really answer that question.
He was talking about the principle. It seemed to be like kind of a connection between subjective probabilities and frequency probabilities.
Sorry, I can't answer anything to that because I don't know what David Wallace said. So.
He was trying to put subjective, trying to propose an objective foundation for probability, not subjective.
Okay, well, I don't know.
It's not explaining why subjective probabilities should be objective. Yeah, okay, so absolutely.
That's an interesting point, but not one that I'm going to discuss. Okay, let's move on to the propensity interpretation. Propensity, as I said, is a form of causality that's weaker than determinism. And one of the features of propensity interpretation is that it allows you to make meaningful statements about individual events. And this is in accordance with the ensemble frequency interpretation when it's applied to repeated experiments. That is, suppose we have a spin a half particle going through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, and we say, what is the probability that it will emerge with spin up? A strict advocate of the ensemble interpretation would say, well, now we have to have a long sequence of these experiments, and there's a certain frequency, relative number of them will come with spin up, and a certain, and the rest of them will come with spin down, and the relative number that goes with spin up relative to spin down is probability, and he makes probability statements only if he can construct an appropriate ensemble to make them. With the propensity language, at least, you can talk meaningfully, at least semantically meaningfully, about the probabilities of single events. It's a chance, that's all. The outcome is supposed to be indeterministic, not predictable, perhaps even, yeah, I already said indeterministic, didn't I? Okay, I don't need to repeat myself. So you can say, what is the probability of getting heads when you flip a coin? On half. We talk this way all the time. It's a natural way to talk in quantum mechanics as well. The propensity interpretation is a little bit more natural when you're considering time-dependent states, and therefore time-dependent probabilities. I'll illustrate this with a version of the Stern-Gerlach experiment that's given here. What I have is the Stern-Gerlach magnet with this magnetic field gradient. The magnet is aligned at the angle theta relative to our coordinate system. And then we have a polarized state, polarized spin state, that is the angle phi. They're not supposed to be right angles to each other, it's just the way I drew the diagram. So a source produces spin a half particles polarized at an angle phi relative to the coordinate axis. The Stern-Gerlach magnet is oriented at angle theta. Question, what is the probability that such a particle, when incident on the apparatus, will emerge spin up, where up is relative to the magnet, not relative to the coordinate system? Well, the formal answer, which you get by calculating the probability, if you all know what it is, it's the cosine squared of half the angle between the polarization direction and the magnetic field gradient direction. So everybody agrees on what the numerical answer is, but what's the interpretation of that answer? Well, in the propensity interpretation, what we say is that the chance or propensity of the particle emerging with spin up is equal to that number p. In the frequency interpretation, we would say, in the long run of similar experiments, the fraction of particles merging with spin up will be approximately p. Doesn't seem like a whole lot of difference there, difference in words, but not a really substantive difference. Let's change the situation a little bit. Let the magnet be reoriented in some arbitrary manner before each particle is released so that theta is different in each case. And then we ask the same question. In the propensity interpretation, we give the same answer. The propensity, or chance, that the particle will emerge spin up relative to the magnet direction is p equals p of theta, where p of theta is given by the formula that you just saw, can't see anymore. In the ensemble frequency interpretation, one must conceptually embed each event in an imaginary long run of experiments. That is, the strict frequency guy would say, well, if you do a whole bunch of experiments for each angle theta, then I can estimate p of theta for you. The experimenter could say, yeah, but I didn't do that. I did one measurement of this value of theta, then I changed it in one measurement, and then I changed it again, did another measurement, then I changed it back here, did another measurement. So the propensity interpretation is at least more economical in its language. But now comes the next situation. Suppose that the polarization theta is unknown. We have a definite apparatus. Theta is not random or anything. It's not being varied. It's just that the apparatus is a black box, and we don't know what the polarization direction is. So the question is, can we infer what the polarization direction of the particle is from the kind of data that we got in number two, where we randomly changed the angle theta of the apparatus and just did one single event at each angle theta? Of course, you can't determine the polarization angle of a particle in an unknown state with a single event measurement. That, I think, is should be obvious, I'll just state it, that there's risk of being totally obvious. We need a whole bunch of data to make it in. So now, can the polarization angle phi be inferred from this data where the apparatus is oriented randomly at different angles theta every time, and you only get one event for each angle theta? Well, at least the instinct of the frequency theorist would be saying, no, I need a long run of events at each angle theta so I can estimate piece of theta as the relative frequency at that angle, and then from my data I'll estimate what p of theta is as a function of angle, and by fitting the formula I'll then estimate what phi is. So unless I can do many events at each angle, I won't be able to do the result. Propensity interpretation guy will say, yes, indeed, we can use Bayesian inference, which is equivalent in this case to maximum likelihood inference, which you know about if you take the statistics course. If you don't know about it, I just have to apologize because I don't have time to go into all the mathematics and teaching of it. But you can indeed, by this method, infer the most probable value of the unknown polarization angle phi. Roughly speaking, even though you don't know what the polarization angle phi is, as you vary your angles theta randomly, you'll tend to get more positive outcomes when your apparatus was oriented close to the true polarization direction than when it's oriented away from it. And you, by appropriate statistical analysis, you can do an estimate. The frequency guy might eventually get the right answer in the long run, but its initial inclination would be to give up too soon. So does this represent a change in my position from my statistical interpretation paper in 1970? Not with respect to quantum mechanics, it doesn't. But I know a lot more about probability theory in the last 35 years than I did then. In 1970, I was a strict frequency guy, and now I recognize the merits of the propensity interpretation. And as I emphasize, these are not in conflict with each other or in competition with each other. They just are applied in different ways. Yeah, Rob, Scott?
That's going to be don't think that the also frequency interpretation people could make any sort of Bayesian inference based on a
I said they probably could. No, I don't say that they can. I just said that their first inclination would be to say no, and then they have on second and third or fourth thought, they say, oh yeah, we can, you're right.
But are you sure? It seems to me on the first inclination they'd be say yes. Where do you start? Say you're playing a card game. If you ask them, you find out what one card is, and you try to update your probabilities about what the other cards are, they're not going to say, oh, I need to see a long sequence of card games where you flip the first. They'll say, yeah, you show me one card, I can use Bayes' rule to figure out the probabilities of a certain card.
I think you're actually using the subjective interpretation there, and that, by the way, is a correct use of the subjective interpretation.
So that's the difference. You think the
No, that's not the difference. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that the ensemble frequency interpretation guy would say this. This is just sort of my gut feeling. It's not based on interviewing people and seeing what they actually believe. So it seems to me that the propensity interpretation is clear for what it's asking. But I agree that both guys, in the end, get the right answer. Okay, now the subjective interpretation. Let me put up this slide. It's going to be provocative, but it's intended to be. I've never seen a coherent exposition of quantum mechanics based on a subjective interpretation of all quantum probabilities, I should say, as representing knowledge. Subjective probabilities can be used legitimately, but I don't think they can be used for some of the fundamental probabilities. Now let me consider some of the situations that are relevant. Notes ahead. The reason I say this, by fundamental probability, I mean something like psi squared of the ground state of the hydrogen atom. Two people who don't know much about quantum mechanics might have different reasonable beliefs about the position of the electron in the hydrogen atom. Reasonable in the sense that that is, reasonable means relative to their rather woefully impoverished state of knowledge. But their subjective beliefs have nothing to do with the probability that we calculate from quantum mechanics, which is completely objective. It's an objective propensity. if you actually measure the position, which is too practical for the hydrogen atom, but it's practical for other quantum experiments, then you will, you can determine experimentally what these probabilities are. And the probabilities are calculated from the Schrodinger equation, and they got nothing to do with anybody's personal beliefs. Another red herring to get out of the way is the so-called uncertainty principle. The use of the word uncertainty suggests that this has to do with subjective knowledge. But I already explained in my previous lecture that, that the term indeterminacy principle is superior, I think, and that these widths of the delta x and delta p that satisfy the inequality, which is due to Robertson rather than due to Heisenberg, is that these are the widths it's the inherent variation that you get out of the state preparation procedure. They shouldn't be called uncertainties at all. It's not really, it's just a terminology problem. Now, what about the subjective probabilities in more realistic situations, though? Yeah?
The problem with your state analysis, while it's true that the ground state of the Hamiltonian or hydrogen atom is an objective law of that atom, to say that some particular system, some particular hydrogen atom isolated in a trap, can be assigned to its state assignment to say that the state is the atom it's currently occupied. Well, the current state assignment is the ground state of the Hamiltonian. It's a separate state.
Yes. Okay, well, you're talking about a situation in which we don't know the state, which is the sort of thing I was going to talk about right now. Here's some situations where subjective probabilities are relevant. Suppose I prepare a state and I keep it secret. I won't tell you what it is, but I'll tell you something. I'll tell you it's one of four possibilities. I'll tell you it's one of three possibilities. I'll tell you it's one of two possibilities. You're separate from each other. Your state of knowledge is different. You then are given one copy of this state, and you're allowed to do one measurement on it. You won't be able to determine the state from this information, unless I'm really nice to you. I say it's one of two orthogonal possibilities. Then you can determine the state. But you, I tell it's one of those two orthogonal possibilities, or one that's halfway in between. You won't be able to determine the state. You with four choices won't either. But you still get some information. And you'll still be able to make some reasonable inferences about it and saying, well, I don't know what the state actually is, but this choice is more likely than that choice. This one's more probable than that. That's a legitimate use of subjective probability, but those probabilities weren't the fundamental quantum probabilities that you calculated from quantum mechanics. This is just the probabilities associated with what I call the information game. I give you some information and you different information. Or take quantum cryptography, where the whole idea is to give information to one person and conceal it from another. Of course, their states of knowledge will be described by different subjective probabilities. But my point is that the use of subjective probability in quantum cryptography, for example, is because it's cryptography, not because it's quantum. You would do the same sorts of analysis for classical cryptography, where you'd estimate what's the probability that the code breaker will succeed. But the fundamental probabilities of quantum mechanics, I do not believe, can be interpreted meaningfully in a subjective way. And where I see people using subjective probability correctly in quantum theory is in situations where you have an unknown state, and you're trying to infer what that state is. And there it's perfectly correct. Now, as I said, one reason why this statement might be controversial is because the subjective interpretation of probability seems, that is, probability representing knowledge, seems to be part of the Copenhagen interpretation. Or at least it was. You can certainly read that in papers by the older guys. The reason for that, I suspect, is that in those days, the best physicists in the world didn't know very much about probability theory. For example, Max Born said that Heisenberg didn't know what a matrix was when he was inventing his so-called matrix mechanics. He succeeded nevertheless. So if Heisenberg didn't know what a matrix was when he was doing his work, I'm pretty sure that those guys didn't know a hell of a lot about probability theory either. I've seen lots of statements, although I haven't had to catalog them, where prominent physicists have said the only reason for probability in physics is because of lack of knowledge. Well, they just didn't know enough about probability theory.
At that time, the most well-known book was von Mises from 1917, the biggest book on home frequency field prediction. So from Norman in 27 and all the company mostly understood probability from Mises sets as frequencies. And they of course didn't know anything about subjective knowledge at that point.
Well, certainly people used in their talk, in what they wrote, they spoke of probabilities as representing knowledge. That's not the same thing as von Mises, so.
Yes.
Okay.
At least von Neumann.
Von Neumann, yeah, okay. Von Neumann was much more mathematical than the average theoretical physicist at the time. Let's see, do I have anything more to say? Although the remaining things in this paper aren't really germane to our topic today, so we've got a few more minutes and probably be more profitable to use it for a general discussion than for me to say any more. Jeff?
Who was your question? Let's thank our speaker again.
What are the strong points? Well, and I regard it as conceptually clear in that it's in close correspondence with what you actually do experimentally. That is, you when you do a measurement, quantum mechanics doesn't predict the result of a single measurement. You have to repeat the measurement many times for the same state preparation in order to get something that's comparable to quantum mechanics. So that's one. The other, of course, were the points I've been talking about, that there are situations where the individual interpretation seems to lead you to a brick wall, and the ensemble interpretation showed you the way forward. Quantum chaos and the classical limit are two such situations. Well, that I think was probably the main point.
And then I'll be where do you think that there's a weakness in the satisfied definition, or maybe if I think about the concept, where do you think there's more work to be done so that we can understand better?
Yeah, I don't think there's a weakness in the sense that we're likely to find something wrong. Where I'd like to see more work done. Okay, I define a quantum state operationally as a collection of probabilities for all observables. But if you define it that way, those probabilities are far from independent of each other. There are all sorts of constraints amongst them which haven't been enumerated. And in fact, the way to find them is, of course, do the calculations with the state vector. So, emphasizing the ensemble interpretation leaves you a little light in this area, I guess. But I don't know any other interpretation that does better, but that's an area in which I'd say better understanding would be desired.
Well, I guess I have a leading question, which is, how do you address the issue of the system interpretation makes kind of minimal statements about how to interpret quantum mechanics in terms of relating mathematical formalism to probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, some of us like out of interpretation statements about what the ontology of the world is.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the system interpretation consistent with an underlying reality?
Yeah, yeah. I've sort of, my attitude towards that, which I don't know whether I've expressed in anything I've published, is that I like to figure out which ontologies are consistent with quantum mechanics and which are not. So the statistical interpretation, you're right, is a broad overview interpretation that's probably consistent with more than one ontology. And whether you call supplying that ontology interpretation or not, because it's just a matter of words, sometimes I've described it as adding to quantum theory. Like take the Bohm theory, for example. He takes quantum theory as it was given to him, and then he adds an additional element that gives him these trajectories. And the statistical interpretation is consistent with that, but doesn't insist that you do that. So, So I try to turn this into a strength by saying that it tells you what avenues are still open. It doesn't tell you which one to take and how to get there, but at least it does probably close off a few false starts. Yeah?
The statistical interpretation does, though, like, give an idea of what is physical, or say a statement of what's physical. Because it, doesn't it say that everything has definite position?
You may say that. I don't think you're forced to say it. If that's all you say, I don't think you're liable to run afoul. But if you generalize it too far and say, well, every dynamical variable has a definite value, it's just that it's fluctuating and we don't know in advance what it is because quantum mechanics doesn't predict it, then you'll run up against Korchnitz factors theorem, which you thought that to them?
Very agreed.
Yeah, okay. So that don't carry that approach too far, or you'll run afoul of things. But certainly, the statistical interpretation allows you to go as far as you can in that direction. Probably even encourages you to go as far as you can in that direction. Yeah.
You say that the uncertainty principle is basically only valid over an ensemble measurement.
Well, I didn't use those words. What I said was that the uncertainty principle, as it's usually presented, the Robertson-Schrödinger inequality, actually applies to the statistical dispersions that are inherent in the state preparation procedure and has nothing to do with measurement at all, although it can be tested experimentally.
Okay, but you wanted to give like an example where, again, when you're picking for this on the web, that we can have, if we take one measurement, we can get better than the Heisenberg uncertainty for...
What paper is that? Retrediction. Yeah. You cannot predict both Q and P by any combination of measurements, but if you do a state preparation at time t equals zero, which maybe defines, which localizes the position, and then at some later time you measure the position at a later time, you can retrodict that the velocity, the momentum had to be such and such. Heisenberg also would have agreed with that if you take the information given you initially by the state preparation, and finally by the measurement, you can retrodict or infer in the intermediate time other things.
But it is possible, then, you're saying, for to get better than a follow to uncertainty for a single measurement?
If you've interpreted that way, yes.
Okay.
Yes?
You brought up Kaufman's paper. As I understand it, you're trying to move away from the hidden variable theories with statistical interpretation by keeping locality, but getting rid of some of the realism.
No, I don't think I'm doing that at all. I haven't talked about locality at all, because the reason I didn't talk about Bell's theorem and locality is because I don't believe Bell's theorem provides preferential support for any interpretation over any object. That's just something I've also argued in print. The reason is that the derivation of Bell's theorem the derivation of the Bell inequalities doesn't involve quantum mechanics, it just involves the idea of locality. Then you compare the prediction of the Bell inequalities with the prediction of quantum mechanics and find that they're not compatible with each other. The only thing about quantum mechanics we use is the probability predictions. And any interpretation of quantum mechanics that agrees with the usual probability prediction will be in exactly the same situation vis-a-vis Bell's theorem. That's why when I'm supposed to be talking about interpretations, I didn't talk about Bell's theorem, because it doesn't favor one interpretation versus another. So I can just leave you with a message here. If you hear somebody arguing that Bell's theorem does support one interpretation versus another, watch him really carefully, because I think he's pulling the wool over your eyes.
So,
okay.
Do you make any assertions about locality versus non-locality in this interpretation?
I'm not sure that I, as a person, make some assertions, but I'm not sure that those assertions should be said to be part of the statistical interpretation. And one thing that I will say is that the conclusions of Bell's theorem are sometimes stated in the following way. Local realistic theories are incompatible with quantum mechanics. You've probably seen that statement. Now, this suggests we have two choices. We must give up locality, or we must give up realism. And I claim that that's a misleading suggestion, because you don't really have that choice. I mean, imagine these four logical possibilities: local realistic, local unrealistic, non-local realistic, non-local non-realistic. I don't think there's such a thing as a non-realistic local theory. I don't think that makes sense. Therefore, if you give up realism, you've already given up the chance of distinguishing between locality and non-locality. So the answer is no, I don't give up realism. I reluctantly give up locality. But I don't think that's a part of the statistical interpretation. That's part of my views on the subject. Back up.
You said that you thought that statistical interpretation was consistent with Bohmian mechanics. And I wonder how that can be, because you're saying that the state vector should be associated with an ensemble of preparations. And I think somebody who believes in Roy Wong would say an individual preparation has a state vector.
Actually, I meant to say something less than that. What I said is that the statistical interpretation, as Joe said, is kind of a broad framework interpretation that doesn't tell you which way to go in future, but allows you to go any of several different ways. And the direction that Bohm, never mind the specifics of Bohm theory, but the idea of adding additional structure to quantum mechanics that's consistent with the existing structure is something that I'm very positive towards. And that's how I viewed Bohm's theory, is he's going to add a little more structure. It's true that at the end of the game, we end up with somewhat different points of view, but I was just referring to the sort of philosophical attitude. The statistical interpretation isn't a fixed, narrow church. It allows for a certain breadth.
I'm not sure it's true that Bohmian mechanics is an example of adding something to statistical interpretation. It could be that Bohmian mechanics violates something that you presume is the interpretation. But I grant that you
In that sense, it does. I agree with you.
We're just adding things. But my question is this: until you provide such a theory, if you want to satisfy somebody who demands an ontology, until you've provided the theory that adds something to the statistical interpretation that gives you an ontology, you haven't shown that it's even possible. So you haven't really shown, so if you're trying to satisfy somebody who wants an ontology, who says, I'm not going to go for any interpretation until it gives me an ontology, you still haven't convinced them that this research program, it's possible that you could get an ontology at the end. So there's work to be done in that direction. I mean, it could be that it fails. And if it did fail, would you say, well, I reject ontology and I'm going to be an operationist? Or would you say, well, I was wrong. Statistical interpretation is not the way to go.
The statistical interpretation doesn't determine a unique ontology, I don't think.
I'm saying it could be that there's no ontology that works.
I'm not sure what that position is, that there is no ontology. Aren't there counterexamples? I mean, the Bohm theory, even if you don't like it, provides an ontology, and that agrees with all the statistical predictions.
But I'm saying Bohm theory violates your assumption, which is that a state vector is associated with an ensemble.
It isn't.
It's a single preparation.
It's just a matter of.
No, it isn't really, because you never control the. There's two things in the Bohm theory. There's the wave function, and then there's the actual position of the part, which is not controlled. And so, in practice, Bohm talks about an ensemble whose probability distribution is given by psi squared. So I don't think they're really incompatible. There's some different. And then if you want an ontology, of course, wait till next week when Phil Pearl gets here. He's going to give you a very interesting one. But I don't consider that just providing an ontology. Phil Pearl's theory is a different theory from quantum mechanics. It differs mathematically, it differs in its predictions, it's falsifiable. I thought it would have been falsified long ago, so I admire him for his success. The reason it's not falsified, but merely falsifiable, is because it contains an adjustable parameter, and any experimental data you bring to bear on it squeezes down the range of possible values of the unknown parameter, but you can't go forever. He's got upper bounds and he's got lower bounds. Conceptually, it could reduce to zero. It hasn't reduced to zero. He's still alive. So I got a lot of respect for him.
Let's do that. Let's take some other questions for this interpretation.
I don't see how this interpretation handles things like entanglement.
statistical interpretation says that the predictions of quantum mechanics are the probabilities that you calculate from the wave function. You can calculate joint probabilities, conditional probabilities, correlations from the two-component wave function, or multi-component wave function, and entanglement is nothing special in statistical interpretation. It's quantitatively interesting and got a lot of interesting things about it, but I don't think it requires any special attention in statistical interpretation.
The only kind of ontological element in statistical interpretation as presented, and correct me if I'm wrong, is propensity interpretation of probability. It's a form of weaker form of causality.
Yeah.
Causality presumes some form of, you know, force or influence, which presumes some kind of realism.
Well, a force can be an influence without being a deterministic influence. If you define causality, as you say, A has a causal relationship to B. If you change A, then B also changes. It may not be a one-to-one deterministic relationship, but if they're related in that way, there's still a causal relationship. At least that's how I use the term. So if it's not deterministic, you have A, and maybe you get B, or maybe you get B1, or maybe you get B2. If you don't have A, you don't get anything, you get C. Then I'd say there's a causal relationship there, but it's not deterministic, and it's expressed as a propensity.
But just the fact that there is that causal relationship, non-deterministic as it may be, I mean, the causal relationship is amongst, I would presume, some kind of ontological properties of the world.
I guess so, yeah.
And so, whereas the outcome is the final event observed, what's the cause?
Well, you can talk about the propensity to roll a deuce with a pair of dice, if you like, even though that really is deterministic.
And there's also a theory of ontology, which
yes.
is the factors that we in.
Of course, you know what the ontology is there. What I'm saying is that it may influence the ontology. I'm not sure it's, I mean, you may be right that it's an ontological element. I don't think it is a total choice of ontology.
Yeah. I have a question for seminar regarding measurement and preparation,
mm-hmm.
also the distinction. So suppose you have a heat oven, some right. silver coming mm-hmm. up, you have a Sterlach apparatus,
mm-hmm.
some will go up, some will go down, mm-hmm. here you put the brick wall,
mm-hmm.
and here you have the rest going down.
Mm-hmm.
Should I consider this as a measurement or as a preparation procedure for spin up?
I think it would be better to count that as a preparation. Particularly, you didn't say you put a detector at the end to verify that they really were spin up. So as long as you don't put the detector there, I definitely say that's a preparation.
But really, so I'm a little bit puzzled here because doesn't this imply the collapse of the wave function? This brick wall, I can say, is a measurement apparatus, you know.
A brick wall is not a measurement apparatus. Otherwise, people would spend millions of dollars on real measurement apparatuses. This is a situation where the collapsed postulate is innocuous and gives you the right answer. But the way I would do it is differently. I would just say, what is the probability that the outcome of this preparation gives you spin up? Or if you want, or you could analyze it in more detail, what is the probability that the particle will get absorbed by the brick wall, things like that. I'd express everything in terms of the probability.
So I can the point is if you do a subspin experiment on the upbeam, you can calculate the results of that subspin experiment based on the conditional probability of them having passed not through the brick wall.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you don't really need a collapse, you can use this group of conditional probabilities to make the predictions.
Yeah.
So
that's basically it. In fact, when the collapsed postulate is correct, it's really just another way of calculating conditional probability.
So my real question is, what state should I use? What state is the real state?
Well, you define your preparation, which you did. You said you have the oven that sends it through a Sterlach apparatus, and you block the bottom output, and you and the only thing you have is the upper output. What state you should use in that case? The state of what we have to say, of course. State for the single particle beam that's coming out. That would be the presumably the state vector spin up.
But a more precise state would involve a coupling with a brick wall.
Oh yeah, you have to define your system as in any
yeah.
situation. So if you want to say what's the state of a system that consists of the upper beam plus the brick wall, then I'd have to give you a more detailed answer.
Well, you gentlemen can take this after the lecture. Are there any last chances for questions from students?
Yeah.
So, I'm not totally sure on this point. Are you saying that you, or at least a devotee of the statistical interpretation, could claim both that there's some sub-quantum theory that the statistics of become quantum theory, sort of the way that the statistical mechanics becomes thermodynamics, or that you could also possibly have a position where you say the statistics are propensity, but there's no sub-quantum theory. It's just that there's no collapse, but quantum theory gives us the probabilities, and there's nothing more fundamental.
I think a person could accept the statistical interpretation. Let's say two people could both accept the statistical interpretation, and one could take one of the views, and the other take the other. I think that's possible. Yeah.
Now, with that ties in with what Rob was asking about whether or not you can be statistical methodology at all.
Okay, you can be an ontological agnostic, I guess. I just have trouble with people who are ontological atheists.
So the positions that you mentioned were the realism versus non-realism. Okay, I have a question about the boiling pot paradox. Zeno's paradox.
What pot? Never boils.
So were experiments actually done all this time?
They built a fire out of wooden logs and they put a pot over it. The experiment was a very different character. It was an optical experiment that involved a three-level atom. I can't remember all the details, but you excite it up to one level, and then it can spontaneously decay to another. And if it does that, then it gives one signal. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the details of the experiment because it was really quite a complicated, non-trivial experiment. The references will be in the literature, which you can track down from the references that I gave you. But the people who did a proper theoretical analysis of it, without to show that you didn't need to use the collapse postulate. They wrote some rather long papers, so it's a non-trivial problem.
I assume they didn't make a fixed number of measurements.
I'm sorry?
I assume that they didn't make a fixed number of measurements. So
well, in quantum optics, the infinite number. Do you say infinite number?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course not. But I don't know how many 10 to the n photons they actually detected. They didn't just do it once, excite the atom once and detect the photon once and then draw a conclusion. In quantum optics experiments, you're doing it many times per second.
So was it, I guess it was people, there was enough space for arguments after that experiment for people who actually hold.
Well, I think I forget exactly what the authors of the experimental authors said, so I don't want to put words in their mouth to make them look foolish or something, but at least it was interpreted by some people as, hey, we're actually seeing the collapse of the wave function. And the theorists had to, including myself, but Asher Perez did his best, had to point out that no, that's not justified at all. Here's the proper theory, and you don't have to sort of collapse. So.
Is the two-slit experiment incompatible with viewing the state as the probability, like just as probability distribution for the ensemble?
No. That's one part of this talk I left out. All probabilities are conditional. Let's see if I can just find one slide that will answer that question.
Was your question about is there some mechanism to explain why we?
Is there another talk in 4 o'clock, by the way? I seem to remember from that.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that it? Yeah, so we have to. Sorry, I guess maybe we can talk privately about it if you want the answer. Better wrap it up.
All right, thank you.